The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Claire Zamorski is a graduate research assistant in translational science at the University of Texas College of Pharmacy and adjunct faculty at the Pharmacotherapy Education and Research Center at UT Health Science Center at San Antonio. She's a paramedic and a harm reductionist and has worked in these areas since 2013, providing outreach, education, and care to people who use drugs in Central Texas. I got in contact because I was reading your article you published recently in Filter magazine. It's entitled New Meth is Nothing to Fear. It isn't new, it's just meth. It was published September 1st, and it debunks some myths about methamphetamine that have been circulating recently. It's a great article, by the way.
Thanks.
What are some of these methamphetamine myths versus reality?
So probably the biggest and most significant myth that we've been seeing in this vein recently is that there has been some kind of a dramatic and so far unexplained or unexplainable difference in the meth that's currently on the market versus prior years' meth, that there's something especially sinister. And a lot of the narrative around it has been especially florid, maybe. Lots of drama, lots of talking about the meth very literally causing mental illness, the meth very literally causing homelessness. And this has been unfortunately accepted and just kind of swallowed down as fact. And if you kind of probe it, it tends to lead back to one source, and none of it is scientifically backed. And, you know, unfortunately, when these things really get traction and really start being spread, especially when they're easy narratives like that, they start really gaining a foothold and affecting policy, affecting decisions and people's lives. So I wanted to start poking some holes in this idea and bring us back to earth.
It's the whole big lie theory. If you keep repeating it, that's how Fox News makes its living. Other sources of disinformation are available. Is methamphetamine on the market getting more pure, I guess, in general? Is that what's going on?
So it's more pure today than it was in the 1970s, but that's not saying a whole lot. I kind of peg the 1970s because that's when we first started seeing the method of meth manufacture that we predominantly see today, which uses a chemical called P2P. So that's the starting ingredient, and then you process it from there. And this is a method that's different than what a lot of us are probably familiar with, which uses Sudafed. So a lot of us are really familiar with that, because now if you want a box of Sudafed at the pharmacy, you got to show your ID, you got to sign a little form and your name and address are tracked to make sure you're not a especially frequent buyer or anything. So I think a lot of people think of Sudafed as the starting component for meth, and you can do that. Like, you can start with ephedrine, but you can also start with a couple of other things. And one of them is this P2P method. So that first started really emerging in the 1970s. It was considered, and to a degree was considered the domain of like biker gangs and trailer parks. Like, it was a heavily classed thing. And we talked about it being dirty and being cheap and had lots of yada yada. And there's a lot that can be said about how we talk about drugs being pure versus dirty based on where they're from and what dirty really means in terms of drugs. But to kind of get back to it, it was less pure then because it was really hard to separate the two isomers, which are like the two physical forms of the molecule. But we've figured it out since then. And there's also a couple of different ways to approach it. So now we actually see quite pure meth. There's one isomer, it's called the D isomer or dextro. So it faces to the right. And that's the psychoactive one. That's the one that gives effect. And then there's L, which you don't want. It kind of makes people jittery, but it doesn't have a psychoactive effect. It has a couple of uses here and there, but it's not anything you would seek out for a high. At any rate, so that was always meant, the description of the mixture of those two was always pretty unpleasant, like lots of headaches and racing hearts and less of the fun. And now we've gotten really good at sorting them out. You can even purchase a machine that'll do it for you. So yeah, we've gotten to a point where the meth is a lot more pure, but that tends to mean something different when you talk about, quote, purity, than if we're talking about an opioid, for example. Because for meth, if we talk about purity, that's almost always what's almost always being referred to there is how much of the meth is D meth, the good meth, the psychoactive meth. If you talk about a pure sample of heroin, for example, you're talking about how much other junk is in there. So fentanyl, caffeine, laxative, whatever the hell else. So yes, it has gotten more pure, but we've had many decades at this point to work on that. So this is not a very sudden in the last couple of years shifts, as is suggested very frequently.
Because that is one of the things, methamphetamine and amphetamine type stimulants. I mean, these are, they're chemically produced. So it's mm-hmm. It's just science. Science makes the progress of science.
Yeah.
It's not really surprising.
It's totally a different domain. It's pretty interesting. We've moved from kind of this dominance of plant-based drugs, of heroin and cocaine, that have to be grown and have to be processed. And now we're moving further away from those, especially for heroin, and into things that are purely synthetic and made in a lab. And meth is one of the granddaddies of that.
I think that's one of the reasons we're not as... I follow a lot of what's going on in Europe and Asia and Africa, as well as here in the U.S. and throughout Abya Yala, for that matter. And the European Union in particular has paid a lot more attention to these novel psychoactives than we have here in the U.S. I mean,
they're fantastic.
It's just... So we're back to the kind of meth that the traditional, the outlaw motorcycle gangs, as they're called, the OMGs, were producing back in the 70s, but with a Walter White twist, real science thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do that pop culture thing to death. By gosh, we'll have to.
No, it's all good. I reference Breaking Bad too.
Well, it's a thing people are familiar with, so it's it is a question of science getting into the, but science was always part of it, I suppose. So for the benefit of listeners who aren't familiar, what does methamphetamine do?
Yeah, so methamphetamine is a stimulant, and that's a good general term. The way that methamphetamine talks to the receptors in our body means that it can contact a few different of our tissues. So we really feel it in our brains. And so that's, you know, why it's called a psychoactive chemical. We feel euphoria. We feel heightened energy, confidence. So these are all, you know, desirable things, but it has a little bit of a broader scope than that. So we, you know, traditionally see folks with a faster heartbeat. It elevates our blood pressure a little bit. It reduces appetite. It dries out our mouth. And that, in fact, is a big thing that drives the meth mouth narrative, which is another thing that I really hate. But one of the things that I think is important in this discussion to know is that we prescribe people D-methamphetamine. You can get it from a doctor. So it's certainly not a very commonly prescribed medication, but it is approved in the US for both ADHD and as a treatment for obesity. And it's called Desoxin. And so I feel like this is an especially important smoking gun when we talk about the narrative that there's something really sinister about street D-methamphetamine, because street D-methamphetamine has gotten only purer over the years, And you can get the same thing from a pharmacy with a prescription. So it doesn't make any sense that the stuff that's on the street would somehow have a magical curse to it, that that alone is, you know, unraveling society, when the same molecule has been FDA approved and can be prescribed by physicians. So yeah, desoxin has, you know, lots of, or, you know, D-methamphetamine in general has both very real, sometimes life-saving applicability to people, and can be prescribed and, you know, monitored that way. So, you know, it's, I think it's important to understand that these substances that we like to, you know, really vilify are just, at the end of the day, they're tools. And it just depends on which tool you need at what time. Kind of like with fentanyl, you know, people get really, you know, incredibly emotional, and understandably so, about fentanyl and helping people. And there's, you know, a movement now to try to classify it as a weapon of mass destruction, for example. I'm like, fentanyl is a fantastic opioid. It's a fantastic painkiller. It works quickly. It works well. But yeah, of course, if you don't know how to dose it, or you're not able to dose it, which is the case for the street supply, and, or if you don't know that it's there, yeah, it's dangerous. So is insulin, for that matter. There are a lot of drugs that we use that really need to be administered carefully to make sure that they're safe to the person. But there are times when we need pain relief urgently. There are times when we need a stimulant so that we can function. So, you know, it just depends on the person, depends on the drug, but, yeah, I really try to pull people back down to earth. I like to talk about drug mythology, because it really feels like we're talking almost about unicorns at a certain point, the way that people get really kind of out in the stratosphere about what they imagine drugs can and can't do. So, and fentanyl is another one of those unfortunately.
Could you talk a little more about fentanyl? Because that's one that, and it's the persistent thing. It's with meth, there's all the different, it's a lot easier to blame methamphetamine for all kinds of social problems than it is to, you know, look in a mirror. Because looking in a mirror is never very pleasant, especially in a society like this. But some of these myths are just ridiculous, and keep on trying to debunk them, and they just keep getting repeated. And fentanyl, talk to me, debunk a couple of these fentanyl myths for me, if you could.
Oh, yeah. This is a particularly interesting point, I think, mostly because the myths around fentanyl have not only been aggressively debunked at this point, well, they've been aggressively debunked, and yet we are continuing to see them be repeated, and it tends to come from law enforcement. So that tends to be where it's focused. And amusingly to me, it's American law enforcement. So if you have law enforcement in other parts of the world, this isn't something that we see there. But having said that, and there's a lot that could be said about the kind of the cultural context there, but the biggest myth that we tend to see with that is that fentanyl has these kind of supernatural abilities. The big ones being that if you glancingly touch it, like dusting some powder off of your shoulder, that it will soak through your skin and take you out, cause an overdose immediately, and down you'll go within a few seconds. We see the same thing for environmental exposure, the idea that if you are in the same room as some fentanyl, that it's somehow like diffusing into the air, and that you need a hazmat suit to be around it and a respirator. So those are the big ones that we see, and it's frustrating, also kind of interesting. It says something about us, and it says something about our fear of fear of other, and fear of like a marginalized other. Like the sociologist Liz Caiarello, I love quoting her. She's written about the poisoned body myth. And this is something that we've seen in a few different contexts. HIV is another good one. The idea that you can't touch these people or be near them, even though we understand up, down, and sideways exactly how HIV is transmitted. There's still people that won't want to touch them. We had issues in the late 80s and the 90s with getting people to perform CPR and mouth-to-mouth because what if? And we're unfortunately starting to see that, or have been seeing that, with people that are experiencing overdoses. You know, we bang the drum about the importance of acting, like help these people, don't just let them lay there, go have naloxone, give it to them, breathe for them. And we get a lot of resistance, like, you know, what if I touch this person and I get the fentanyl on me and then I die? And the thing is that when you're hearing this repeated by people that you're supposed to be able to trust, I understand where that comes from. You know, the general public shouldn't have to, you know, fact check every single thing that comes out of all of these different agencies. Like we spend, you know, my colleagues and I, we spend plenty of time just hunting down these myths and doing the detailed and fine work of picking apart what they're saying to be able to give the public a responsible, you know, retort. And that's work. And not every person in America's got the time and bandwidth to do that. So it's frustrating, but, you know, I'm not really frustrated at individuals. I'm frustrated at the organizations that choose to prop this up. And yeah, so, but to be clear, fentanyl doesn't do that. Fentanyl has been approved for medical use for many decades at this point. And when you apply to the FDA to market a new drug in the US, you have to present them with reams of data. Like, they require so much. There's a reason why drug development is so expensive. So we understand fentanyl really well. This is something we made in a lab. We tested it aggressively. We know what it can and can't do. And it cannot quickly soak through the skin. It does not like to float around in the air. Even fentanyl skin patches, which tend to be the big retort, they're like, hey, fentanyl can go through the skin. It can, but the development of that patch was a big effort. It took a long time. And the patches contain a very big dose of fentanyl plus materials in there to help it move past the skin. And what we see out in the world for people using illicit fentanyl is that it's a crumbly dry powder, small amounts typically, and dry things like powders are especially bad at getting through the skin. There's a reason why if you're prescribed, you know, a medicine for your skin, it's probably an ointment or a cream that can spread onto the skin. That helps things move through our skin. So the science is crystal clear, but man, this is one that won't die. It just keeps resurfacing. We've had some things again. The rainbow fentanyl brouhaha has brought it back up to the fore. So, you know, we keep on going. I'm hopeful that in a few years we'll look back on this and feel embarrassed that this was ever such an issue, but yeah, we're not there yet.
That was part one of my interview with Claire Zagorski, a harm reduction activist, paramedic, graduate research assistant in translational science at the University of Texas College of Pharmacy, and adjunct faculty at the Pharmacotherapy Education and Research Center at UT Health Science Center at San Antonio. Her article, New Meth is Nothing to Fear, It Isn't New, It's Just Meth, was published September 1st at Filter Magazine. We'll hear the rest of that interview on next week's show. Now, while we still have time, in the last couple of weeks, we've heard my interview with award-winning journalist and best-selling author Maya Solovitz. There's one last segment of that interview you haven't heard yet. Here it is. All right, well, look, this next one's personal. I've been working through some stuff of my own lately. Stopped using alcohol entirely about 11 months ago. Did it for my physical health. But quitting alcohol has really opened my eyes to a lot, you know, about myself, about my life, how I think, how I interact, bad decisions. And I'm not using alcohol to close my eyes again so I can ignore it all. And, well, I guess I am now in what one would call recovery. And I think this is one of those not so much a question as a statement kind of things, but I haven't been to a conference for a while, so, you know, thought I'd throw that one in. But I wanted to thank you. I wanted to thank you. It's your work. In particular, one of your other books, the one before this one, Unbroken Brain, has been such a huge help as I've been going through this process and thinking. And, you know, you can't turn back time to correct any of those mistakes and do it right. But, you know, the best I can do now is to try and atone, to make amends. Anyway, trying to get past the kicking myself for all those mistakes part. I'm getting there. And I just wanted to let you know I'm really grateful to you for helping me all through this. I just wanted to let you know that. And so, well, while we're on the subject, do you have any thoughts you can share about recovery?
I mean, I think what's interesting to me is that, well, first of all, congratulations. And, you know, it's hard and it's wonderful. And I think, you know, recovery is going to be different for every person. And the way to maintain it is just the way to doing things that are healthy instead of the things that we sometimes do that are unhealthy. And also, you know, trying to be easy on ourselves, like not beating ourselves up for like, oh, I should have done this, I should have done that, what if I did this? You know, that that will get you in trouble. I mean, I found, especially early in my recovery, like one of the things that was most helpful was to stop hating myself for hating myself. And when I could sort of get rid of the meta level of self-hatred, then it was just kind of, okay, all right, I'm here. How am I going to deal with this? Let's like move forward. And I think, you know, for people who do the 12 steps, I think the 12 steps could be useful for any human being. And my objection to them is only when they're forced on you as part of treatment, and people are paying for what you should be able to get for free. Now, different things work for different people, but the thing about the steps is if you are one of these people who's constantly beating yourselves up, the whole process of moral inventory and all that is like about stopping that, you know, because, okay, now we know exactly what's wrong. We know who we wronged. We can make amends. And then we can stop beating ourselves up for it. That is like a kind of, it puts it right in the past. And so I think that's a useful process for any human being. I just have an objection when people with addiction are singled out as the only people who would benefit from that. And the only condition in medicine that has a moral inventory, which is stigmatizing. So it's a complex position that doesn't make a good sound bite. But, you know, the reality is that that can be helpful to some people in recovery. Other people, on the other hand, use that to like, you know, and there's some terrible stuff that people do with the way the moral inventory stuff is written in the 12 steps to be like, okay, well, what was my part in being sexually abused? Nothing. You were a child. You know, like assuming that like everything that you're angry or resentful about is down to something you did is terrible. And that part, you know, really they should just change that. But the idea, you know, so this, you know, again, I think it's like medicine, you know, everything that can help can probably also harm, except for kindness. I've never seen an example where being kind actually was harmful. But for the most part, you know, a medication that might be like saving my life might kill you. And similarly, an approach to recovery that like is really helpful to me might be harmful to you. So we need to sort of find what those things are and not be forcing things on people.
Where can people find your books, your other writings, your website, social media stuff?
Sure. So it's Maya SZ. So it's just Maya, M-A-I-A, S like Sam, Z like zebra.com is my website. And you can basically find my books wherever books are sold. If you can't find them there, please ask for them. Go to your favorite indie and say, why don't you have this? That would be good for me and for you. And also, you can always, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. There's a great collection of indies that is called bookshop.org. And you can get there. I know it's there. And so, you know, whatever your favorite place is to get books, you can usually get it from. And, you know, I'm really, it's just been really cool to see people respond to this, because a lot of the response has been, especially from younger people who are just starting in harm reduction, of which there are an enormous number, oh, wow, I know what my elders did. And while that makes me feel old, it also is really pleasing, because so many people are now seeing, you know, oh, this is an idea that has a history. This is where this came from. You know, and these are the people that, you know, struggled a lot of their lives to bring these ideas out there. I think people in the South are still struggling with the intense opposition that we experienced in the early days of AIDS, and that, like, we fought through, so that now, you know, for example, federal policy is better, and state policy in places like New York and California is definitely better, not where it needs to be, but better. So also the thing that really struck me with this book was, you know, things did not change enough, but they have changed enormously in a lot of places in a very positive way. And sometimes when you're in activism or journalism and you're trying to open the eyes of people to things that are problematic, it feels like banging your head against a wall. And then, you know, but when you look at the arc of history here, it actually has got a lot better. We still have a really long way to go, but we have really come far too. So I think it's really a lot of people, including myself, got a good sense of optimism by looking at this. And right now I'm seeing a lot of cool stuff in terms of people who are doing harm reduction work and mixing it with other paths of recovery, so that it's not like either abstinence or harm reduction. And so that people can find the path that works for them at the particular time in their life that they happen to be. And just seeing that happen after seeing this clash, I mean, I think at the very first harm reduction conference ever, which is, I think, in 96 or something like this, at least the US one, there was a panel, I believe, about, you know, 12 step versus, you know, harm reduction kind of thing. We're still having that, but we're getting better. And we're still, you know, working on being ecumenical and bringing the multiple paths to not be judgmental of each other and to, like, work towards common goals. So it is nice to see. I mean, it's kind of funny because the same debates will recur, but there is also progress.
It's a tough, it's judgmental. It's so tough. It's so tough. I was doing an interview and I made a terribly judgy comment about tea drinking, and I realized later it's like, what an idiot I was. Oh my God, I'm still too ashamed to even anyway, sorry, little tangent. But that's the thing, I've said that before. If recovery just meant that you stopped using. Well, what the hell have you recovered from? You've stopped using whatever it was that you were taking for symptomatic relief, but what have you actually recovered from? That's why, you know, what I say, just stopping use of alcohol wasn't enough. I mean, I didn't think of myself as being in recovery. I had just stopped using alcohol. Right. It was a couple months in that I realized, oh, okay, no, I'm in recovery now. That was from my interview with award-winning journalist and best-selling author Maya Solovitz. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.